Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Therefore I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air. But I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. Now, I'm putting a map up there. What I want you to realize is Argos is about right here, and right here is Corinth. Olympia is over here. Delphi is up here. Those were the four cities that had games. Okay? The Olympic Games were held at the base of Mount Olympia. And it was an area where it had a statue of Zeus. It was they had a sanctuary there to Zeus. Zeus being the god of the sky. And any of you who follow your Greek history and stuff like that know that he was basically the ruler of the Olympian gods. Zeus was the man. That's where the Olympics, as we think of today, originated. And they had them every 4 years, just like they do now. Argos was founded by Argus, who was a son of Zeus. And games were held at that place also. And just to the northwest of Argos, there was a town called Nemea. And that's where the games had been. And then when Argos came in and founded Argos, the games were moved into that area. This Mean games, which were held at Corinth, just north of the city, and it was called that because that was an isthmus in there, was also where they had a sanctuary to Poseidon. And most of you have heard of Poseidon. Years ago, they made a movie, The Poseidon Adventure. It was about a big ship. Well, he was the god of the sea and was a brother to Zeus. And so games were held there on a regular basis. And keep in mind now, I'm telling you all this because it all relates to what he's fixing to tell them in these last four verses. A lot of travelers came in, so there were people there in Corinth, and there was always travelers. And some of these other games were held every year to every other year. So the Olympic Games were held every 4 years. But the others were held intermittently in between. They basically had games going all the time. And then Delphi, which is across the sea, so to speak, across that river, up. Uh-oh. That was not a good thing. It was right up here. Delphi is where it was originally called Pytho. And it was because Apollo killed a python at that place. And so they called it the Pythian Games at that place. And it was the sanctuary of the god Apollo, who was a son of Zeus. Zeus, they say, released two eagles. One went east and one went west and supposedly flew around the world. And where they came back and met was at Delphi. And Delphi became the center of the Greek universe, so to speak. That was the center of the universe. Now, I've said all of that to say this. Do you think religion, okay, was important to the Greeks? Well, absolutely. They had sanctuaries and statues to all the gods that they worshiped. Of course, we understand this was all idolatrous. But they were very religious in that sense. What else were they? Think about Acts chapter 17 and verse 22. They were superstitious. Remember when Paul went to Mars Hill? What did they have? What had he seen all around the cities? He had seen these idols and monuments to every god known to man, and they even had one to the unknown god. Okay, so I said all that to say this. They were extremely, extremely religious, and they were extremely superstitious. Now, the last thing I want to show you is, if I can even see it up there, and if I could quit hitting the wrong buttons, right over in this area is Marathon. And if you look at from Marathon down to the southwest is where Athens is at. Does anybody remember what Marathon was famous for? Okay, there was a huge war there between the Greeks and the Persians. And they were not expected to win this war. The Greeks were not. But anyway, they did. And they had a messenger named Pheidippides who ran from Marathon all the way down to Athens. And he said, "We were victorious," and fell over dead. How many miles was it? Who said 26? A marathon that's run today is 26.2 miles, and that's where it gets its name from this man running from Marathon, where they had just fought this battle, down to Athens to tell them we won, okay? So, they're superstitious, they're religious. Here's the other thing. They are very much into their games. They're huge into their games. And they were so into it that many people paid professionals, kind of like we do today, to train them for these games. So when we get down to the point in these last four verses, and Paul says, don't you know that those that run in a race all run, but one receives the crown? One wins, and he tells them, run to win. Do you think they could understand that with all that went on in that area as far as races and all the different things that happened, the training that went into it? He's saying something that they would understand. And then in verse 25, every one of you competes for the prize, is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we an imperishable. So everyone that is striving for mastery over something has self-restraint. That's what he means when he says temperate. And they do it for a crown, but it's a perishable crown. These people train for months and months and months, and sometimes for years, depending on which one of the races or which one of the events. And they did a lot of the same things that are done today. They threw the discus and the javelin. They had fighting. They had all different types of races. So they trained for months and months and months, and they did it for a perishable crown. Does anybody know at Mount Olympia when they had the Olympics what the prize was that was given? It was a stalk of parsley. Okay? Is that perishable? Pretty quick. So these people trained for months and months and months basically just to get the name that they had won. And then they were given something that was very perishable. And then in verse 26, Paul says, therefore I run, not with uncertainty, thus I fight, not as one who beats the air. And Paul is saying, I run not without knowing the object of my aim. I know what I'm aiming for. I know what I'm striving for. And I'm not just beating the air for nothing. Now, one of the big things they had in most of the games was boxing. And it probably did not resemble what we know today as boxing. But when he says that I'm not just out there beating the air, would they understand that? They would. I'm not just out there flailing my arms. I'm practicing to strike the blow, to win, as it were. And that's what he's telling them. Make sure you're striving to win this. And then he says, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should be disqualified. So he's bringing his body into subjection so that when he's out there preaching, he doesn't become unfit, he doesn't become disqualified. And we had talked about Paul did these things and he did it for free, at least for the Corinthians. He wasn't charging them. He didn't want anything to disqualify or make him unfit, or what's the word we've been using? He didn't want to cause a what to them? A stumbling block. Exactly. He did not want anything to trip them up on their way on the journey that they were taking. So I think these last four verses, he's speaking to them in a way that they easily understand that. I can relate this to several years ago. My oldest son went to the Holy Lands with Brother Waldron and several others. And when they got up on the side of the mountain, on the northeast side of the Sea of Galilee, and Brother Waldron actually quoted Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And Al said when he got to the part about the birds of the air, he said there was literally birds flew over. He said when you looked around and talked about the flowers in the field, he said they were all around. And the point was that Jesus used things that were right there readily available to teach the masses. Paul is using something that they would understand, using the various terms and talking about things related to all these games that they had all around them. So I hope that explains that in such a way that it makes it kind of vivid for you. And helps you to understand what he was saying. Any thoughts or comments on that? So we move into chapter 10, and actually several of these verses, and I don't really have a cutoff where I want to put these, but Doug, look up Exodus 14, 21, and 22, and Mike, look up John 6, 31. And Gary, if you will, look up Exodus 17 and 6. And when I call those out, you can read those. Paul says, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness." So I'll just stick all of those up there. Paul wanted them to know that their fathers were under a cloud, and they passed through the sea. Now, keep in mind, this is a mixed group of people. There's Gentiles, and there's Jews there. So when he says, your fathers were under a cloud, is he just talking to part of the group? No, spiritually, he's talking to all of them. Those people who had done the things necessary to bring us the old law and the new law and all, they were part of our spiritual, Abraham would be part of our spiritual family, okay? So he's talking to all of these people, and he's letting them know they were under a cloud. They were baptized under Moses in the cloud. How did that happen? How can you be baptized just walking through the sea? Well, the walls were up on the water, and the cloud, which had been directly over them, had kind of moved back, because what was it doing at this point? It was separating them from the army chasing them, okay? It was making sure, if you read the scriptures, in fact, it's whoever I gave Exodus 14, 21 and 22, go ahead and read that. I think that's a very interesting scripture. The waters were a wall to them. When you're talking about a river, what's a river do? It flows. So when God sent that wind, and it stopped this water over here, how come this over here didn't just flow away from it? Well, it must have been a miracle. It must have been because God kept all of that water in the same place, okay? And I've always thought that was interesting, but they went down into it, and if you read, the cloud had separated them. But the cloud also provided at night light for the children of Israel and complete darkness and confusion for the army chasing them. So clearly God's taking care of them here, and he's relating this to them. He's saying they were baptized under Moses in the plowed in the sea. Okay? So then he says, they ate the same spiritual food. Whoever's got John 6:31, read that. He gave them bread from heaven. God took care of them. It's amazing to me, and I don't know everything that happened, okay? I read one time how many train cars loaded with food and supplies would have to come in weekly to take care of these people. It was an astronomical. Of course, that varies based on what you think the number was, but the number falls somewhere between 1 million people and 2.5 million people based on the numbering of the men. And it was a massive amount of people. It took a lot of food. How come their sandals weren't wearing out on them? How come their clothes weren't wearing out on them? I think God took care of what their needs were. Kind of like when the apostles went out, he said, just take the clothes on your back and everything else will be taken care of. And I'm paraphrasing that, of course. But that's basically what happened. And it says they drank the same spiritual drink. Gary? So the people were hungry and thirsty, and God brought them in food, and then when they got really thirsty, he told Moses, he said, "Well, you strike that rock and they can drink all they want. If you were looking for water, where is the last place you would go to look for water? In a rock." I mean, honestly, you know, I'm not looking at a rock to get any water out of it. Might look under it and see if there's a little bit of dew or something like that. Did God give them drink from a rock more than once? Yeah, he did. And on one of the occasions, we know that when Moses was supposed to speak to the rock, he got angry and he did what? He struck the rock. And did God just strike him dead because he did that? No, he didn't. But what did it cost him? It cost him the ability to lead the children into the promised land because he did not, at that point, glorify God. And I think he said, "Must we?" And that put Moses kind of on a plane with God when he said that. "Must we do these things for you?" And so, anyway, God said, "I'm going to take you up on a mountain and let you look in, but you're not going." What is interesting to me is that Moses was 120 years old. He was nearly a crippled and blind, right? He had great health. He had almost perfect eyesight. And God took care of Moses because, honestly, I think there's very few people, except maybe for David, who was a man after God's own heart, that did what God wanted him to do the way he wanted him to do it. Moses was a wonderful servant. And so, anyway, they had this drink. And then it says in verse 5, "But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness." And in Numbers chapter 32 and verse 13, it says, "The Lord's anger was kindled against Israel, and he made them wander in the wilderness 40 years until all the generation that had done evil in the sight of the Lord was consumed." So, Paul is telling the brethren here, your fathers traveled under a cloud. They traveled through a sea. They were essentially baptized, so to speak, and that would be something they would understand, the need for baptism, unto Moses in the cloud of the sea. They ate the same spiritual food. They drank the same spiritual drink. And was God pleased with all of them? Not even close. That's the whole point of what he's telling them right here. They all enjoyed the same spiritual blessings. They had the same spiritual food, the same spiritual drink, but God God was not pleased with a lot of them. God did all these things for them. Did God ever even consider just wiping the whole nation out and starting over? Yeah, I think on two different occasions he did that. And Moses was like, whoa, wait just a minute now. Okay? And I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but I'm giving it to you in today's language. If you wipe these people out and take them all off the earth, okay, I understand you're going to start a new family with a new group of people with me, but all those Egyptians over there, they're going to say, well, God couldn't deliver. He took his people out into the wilderness and he killed them because he couldn't give them what he promised them. They all left in vain. And so God changed his mind, okay? And I hate to say that God changed his mind, because I think of God as somebody who's absolutely perfect, and I think he is, and that he doesn't make mistakes, and I don't think he does. But what is that verse, or what is that thought? What does that teach us about God? He hears our prayers. When we petition him, he hears our prayers. Prior to hearing that prayer, what else does it tell us about him? He's long-suffering. And all of these are absolutely right. You know what it tells me? It tells me that he is long-suffering. He does hear our prayer. It tells me God can get upset. Now, I say that to say this. All these people today, well, God's a loving God. Are you telling me that a God who loves his creation would condemn them to a place of torment forever and ever and ever? Yes, he would. Because they did not obey him, God killed a lot of them in the wilderness. He let them wander around for 40 years until all those that had disobeyed him died. Somebody help me here. It was either age 20 or age 21 that those that were that age and younger got to go into the promised land. Those that were older than that died in the wanderings. God continually punished his people when they didn't obey him. So for us to think that God's too loving a God, too caring to punish people, is just, that's a vain thought. It's not going to happen. And I really think on the day of judgment, a lot of people are going to be shocked. What does Matthew 7 teach us that a lot of people think? Absolutely. Absolutely. Those that say unto me, Lord, Lord. You know, what does he say they've done? They've done many wonderful things. They had good intentions. And if you read Matthew 7, where he's talking about that, a lot of those people had done good things. Were they morally good people? Yes, they were. How many have ever known somebody in a denomination that was the salt of the earth? Someone that you just thought the world of? Someone that you never heard say something crass out of their mouth? Someone who went to their denomination on a regular basis, who gave money. I mean, they're just good, moral people. How many of you have ever known somebody like that? I've known people. I've known a lot of people like that. What does Matthew 7 say? If you're not doing God's will, it don't matter how good you are. Now, these people weren't punished because they were good. They were punished because they had sinned. They had done wrong. But the bottom line is there's going to be a lot of people that do not make it into heaven because they weren't doing God's will, though they felt like they were, they thought they were, okay? And that's one of the things I think it's incumbent upon us to do our very best to try to teach people. Doug? Yeah. It's a very good point. Doug says, God isn't punishing these people out of revenge. There's no revenge in God's heart. He's doing it because they did not obey him. One of the verses we'll get to in a few minutes talks about how much and I'm paraphrasing this in my mind the way I look at this verse, but it talks about how much God loves us in that when we sin, He's got a way for us to escape. He's going to take care of us. Okay, so we'll get down to that in a few minutes. In chapter 10, verse 6, now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. So he's talking about these examples. And he said, don't lust as they lusted. They when Moses went into the mountains to talk to God face to face in the wilderness, so to speak, and I'm using that term face to face in the sense that he was in the very presence of God, what did the people almost immediately do? They started partying. Oh, this is a good time to party. Moses isn't here, you know. So they had lust, and I'm going to say this, they had human lust. Has that changed in the last 3,500 years? No. People still have lust, okay? And it doesn't have to be, we don't have to think of the lust as something necessarily that's sexual. It can be for a lot of other things, but they absolutely certainly had these, and he's telling them, these are examples, okay? Don't lust like they did. In verse 7, he says, don't be... Let me just read the verse. And do not become idolaters as were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor complain as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. So, he'd given all these different things that these people were, okay? In Exodus 32, in verse 6, and I'm just going to turn over there because I'm going to... 32 and verse 6, and they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat, to drink, and rose up to play. And in verse 8, they turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They made them a molten calf and have worshipped it and have sacrificed thereunto and said, these be the gods, O Israel, which have brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. What did we say last week about the guy that cut down the tree? Oh, he made him a fire to warm himself and he cooked him some food and then he carved an image and say, oh, you're my God. And so here these people, they had taken off their earrings and their braces and necklaces and all this stuff. And Aaron had fashioned them a golden calf. And then they're partying and these are the gods which brought us up out of the land of Egypt. How can you say something like that after you've done watching the sea separate? And by the way, did they walk across on muddy, wet ground? Dry ground. How can you see those kinds of things? How can you see all the things that happened while you were still in Egypt? How could you see all those children killed? And it wasn't all children. Some of them were adults, but they were the firstborn that died, and none of yours died because you put some blood on the lintel and the doorpost. How can you see all that stuff and then, you know, think, oh, this golden calf's brought us up out of the land? Then if you go down to verse 22 and 23, it says, and Aaron said, let not the anger of my Lord wax hot. Thou knowest the people that they are set on mischief. For they said unto me, make us gods, which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we want not what is become of him. They had no idea where Moses had gone to, so to speak. And in verse 28 it says, and the children of Levi did according to the word of the Lord, and there fell of the people that day about 3,000 men. So here is a group of people who have ate and drank and started partying and bowed down worshiping this golden calf. And Moses basically instructs the the children of Aaron go in among the group and kill those that are worshiping. Do that. And it says about 3,000 of them fell that day. So is God, as Doug said, not seeking revenge now, or seeking vengeance. He's not trying to get even with them, so to speak. But the bottom line is these people were doing evil, and he's going to exercise judgment on them. If God had not at any time during this wandering, if he had not killed some of these people, and I'm going to just say this, it was a cleansing, more or less, how pure would the race have been by the time they got to the land? Not very, okay? And I think, you know, he had to do what he had to do. He said, don't be fornicators, okay, as some were. And in Numbers chapter 25, verse 1 and 2, Israel abode in Shittim. The people began to commit whoredom with the daughters of Moab. And they called the people unto the sacrifices of their gods, and the people did eat and bowed down to their gods. And in verse 9, and those that died in the plague were 24,000. And there's, I'm not going to get into it, but there's a long explanation of why some say 24 and some say 23, and one is in the old law and one is in the new law. And so we're just going to say there's not a controversy there. It's just in the way it was presented. But 24,000, 23,000 people died in that day because of a plague, because they were taking in the people and mixing in with people they shouldn't be mixing. God was trying to establish a race of people that would ultimately bring about Jesus. And sadly, the people mixed in with other races and were basically polluting. We don't have to get into that. What we need to say is these people were not obeying God. He told them not to go in among these people, not to intermarry with these people, and there was a reason for that. Now, I want to say this. Should we stay away from intermingling with other races today? With other races of people. No, we don't have to do that. But there was a reason God wanted them to do that. Okay? So, we just want to be clear on that. We're not saying it's wrong if one of our daughters or one of our sons marries someone from another race. There's nothing wrong with that. Okay? What does the Bible teach us about all of mankind? What do we all have in common? We all have the same blood, okay? I don't know how many of you ever watched the series MASH, but they had one where the guy needed a blood transfusion. And there was a black gentleman who had the same blood type as him. And he told the doctors, don't give me his blood. Now, let me tell you, it was a lot worse than that went on back in the 50s and 60s. And up into the 70s, and probably still goes on today in lots of places in the world. But we all have the same blood. God told these people not to intermingle. And when they did, and it wasn't just intermingling, they were going to the sacrifices and bowing down and worshiping these people's idols. So anyway, they couldn't do that. And then in Numbers 14 and 2, it talks about them murmuring, and that's a reference to verse 10 where he says in there, nor complain, and some of them also complain. Some of the translations use murmur, and they were destroyed by the destroyer. Verse 11, now all these things happened, all these things we just read about now, all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition upon the ends of the ages have come. So, Paul's once again talking about These things are examples that were written for us. They were written for our admonition. What does Romans 15:4 say? Whatsoever things were written aforetime, okay, we have the Old Testament to bring us to the New Testament with an understanding of why these things happened. Okay? I think I've heard Steve say that we couldn't understand the New Testament without an understanding of the Old Testament. And I think that is correct. But that's the reason we have these things, so that we can learn. We can look back. Now, we're not going to fall down and start doing the Ten Commandments. We're not going to set up an altar in here or outside and bring up animals. And we're not going to do that. But the Old Testament had a purpose, and that purpose was to bring us to the New Testament. It was to bring us to Jesus Christ. There was a lot of people, there still are a lot of people today, that think we've got two testaments because God couldn't do what with the first one. He couldn't do what he needed to do. He made a mistake, so I'll just write a New Testament or another testament. Well, that's not the case at all. By the way, when did God plan all this out? For the foundations of the earth. Absolutely. All right, and then in verse 12, he says, therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Okay? Have you ever known someone that was full of themselves, very maybe arrogant or whatever? The self-appointed proclaimer of knowledge, and they're always pointing the accusatory finger, and then all of a sudden they completely collapse. Everything, the world just comes in. Now today, we very frequently hear the word karma used. Boy, karma hit them pretty hard, hit them pretty fast. Well, he's telling these people, don't get to the point where you think you're sitting up here, and then all of a sudden you come way down here. You can fall. Of course, this is one of the best passages that you can use when talking to someone who believes once saved, always saved. Because he's talking to Christians here, and he tells them, if you think you stand, take heed lest you fall. All right, I've rushed through the last 2 weeks. I'm going to stop and let all of you take care of business before worship. We'll start right there and try to get finished up next week. Thank you.